This is Car Expert.
It was just one of the old Holden Sixes that they just basically hacked two cylinders off, and they put it in their Toyota Corona as well.
Both of these cars are really quiet, really smooth, and really punchy in town.
We sort of took the old car and as many design cues that we could find in the old car, we put into the new car.
No car company is ever going to go, well, we were giving 5 years officially, but now we're going to go back to three. You know, the internet would melt.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner. Hello to Paul Marrick.
G'day, Mandy.
And Al Borsfeller, hello.
Hey, how are you going?
Got two of the co-founders on this week, which is cool.
No swearing this time, though.
Yeah, no language warning for this one, so I've got to really keep it clean.
Have you got any plans for the Founders podcast?
We do, yeah, actually.
We do. Yeah, we're going to discuss the second full throttle trip as well at some point. There's a couple of other ideas floating around. Hey, Paul, like there's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah, we've actually we want to be interviewing some of the people we've dealt with in our previous lives, and there's someone who we're about to line up now that has a very similar company name to us. So I'll be looking forward to seeing how that goes.
Awesome. Very exciting news that carexpert.com.au is going to get a refresh of the site.
Yeah, absolutely, Mandy. Our guys have been working pretty much 24 hours a day for the last 2 or 3 months now, Paul. So I think it's worth pointing out that the current version of the site that you see is what we refer to as like a minimal viable product. It's an MVP that we sort of launched with just to get us going and be able to publish content. But I guess this version of the site that's coming live next week, or by the time you hear this, will actually be really what we were aiming to launch with to start with. So there's a lot of new stuff coming. And I think the other thing is that it's also the beginning of where we're going. So it's probably about 15% of there in terms of functionality. And it's just going to be a product onslaught from then on. So we just got the foundation right now. And I'm actually really excited because not only does it look really good, and we've taken a lot of your feedback on board. So for example, you can switch between dark and light mode. And in fact, it even does that for you by default. So if you're looking at it on your iPhone late at night, it'll actually realize that your phone's in dark mode and switch automatically to dark mode. And then in the morning, it'll go into light mode. So a couple of really cool features, but also a whole list of other things. I'm really, really impressed by the search feature we have, which is something that we really struggle with the old place. So it's amazing how well it works now.
It's so quick too.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We're actually genuinely excited about it because, like Albor's said, we've taken the feedback everyone's given. I think a lot of people assume that when they email and say, I don't like this, that we just delete the email and just ignore it. But we've been collating this list of feedback from everyone. And like Albor said, the search will blow you away. I've never seen anything like it before in terms of the speed. Like it is bloody cool. We've got a really cool just wait until you see it. Once you see it, let us know what you think. Send us in your feedback and we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. I think that's the main thing is just to let you know that there will be but most likely by the time you're listening to this, there is a new site and we would love to hear your feedback on it. There will be a specific post about it on the site. So if you can collate your comments in there, bugs or things like that. But yeah, we're trying to build something very different to where we were and sort of even where we were here. A lot of new features. We're really going to focus on the ability for people to ask us about what car to buy because as Paul will attest to this, that's pretty much the most common question we get. And we get so many emails every day of people going, hey, I've got X amount of money. I've got these needs. What should I buy? And we answer them as much as we can. We just thought it'd be really cool if we had a place where all of these can be put together so that other people can have a look as well. So that's going to happen as well. There's a whole Ask an Expert section that's built, which I think is actually the best feature of the site for anyone that's actually in market, which is the people that we talk to.
Really exciting, guys, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. And here is this week's car news. Over to you first, Paul. The 2023 Ford Bronco Raptor is, accidentally leaked on LinkedIn this week.
Yeah, this is fantastic. Normally, it's sort of the automotive media that does all the leaking, but this one was by a Ford employee, and I think it was entirely unintentional. So there's a Ford employee who is an EDS systems engineer at Ford Motor Company, and listed on their LinkedIn profile, they've been at the company for 28 years. They have EDS systems engineer for the past 10 years, and currently designing EDS systems schematics for the 2021 Bronco and the 2023 Bronco Raptor. So they've accidentally unveiled exactly what they're doing and also confirmed that there is a Bronco Raptor coming, which I guess is kind of the worst kept secret ever. But it's interesting because the Bronco has been incredibly well received globally. We had a story not that long ago that there's a potential it's coming to Australia. We were also able to exclusively reveal that this vehicle is coming with a V6 EcoBoost. We've seen that Ford is testing an F-150 Raptor with a supercharged V8 to take on the Ram T-Rex. So I'm hoping that this Bronco actually has something meaty under the bonnet. I think it would really bode well with a big old supercharged V8.
I think a lot of people have some fun with some fully sick exhausts as well.
Who needs an exhaust?
This is not the first time information from Ford has been leaked on LinkedIn. Was there something with Mustang a few years ago?
Yeah, it's actually happened quite a few times, and I think Ford has put policies in place now to try and prevent this. But what'll generally happen, and I certainly don't know it's the case here with this person, but if you're looking for a new job, you want, you know, the latest LinkedIn profile. And I suspect that if this person is looking for a new job and they have this in their LinkedIn profile, it wouldn't surprise me if they kind of just wanted to draw a little bit of attention to themselves and perhaps use this as a catalyst to make that happen. I'm not saying that's the case, but, you know, it seems odd that you would list a program that doesn't exist anymore and you would update your LinkedIn profile to have this information right around the time that all this sort of stuff's being talked about. So it seems a little bit odd to me.
Alborz Land Rover have launched with a 5-year warranty for the Defender today.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting move, but at the same time, I kind of look at these car warranties and I just sort of feel like they're all really 5 years, regardless of what the manufacturer says. But I'm glad that Land Rover has actually come out and said that it's technically and officially 5 years and a limited kilometre too. So I think it's going to give people a bit more confidence. But as I've always told people, you know, it doesn't matter what the car company says about the warranty. The Australian consumer law basically gives you a 5-year warranty, if not longer, as it is. So, you know, if you've got a 3-year warranty on a car and you've got an issue in year 4, hey, fight for it. Send us an email and I'll sort of explain to you how to go about that, because it's all about, you know, a reasonable period of time. But, you know, again, great move by Land Rover though. So it's really good for them to actually just put it on paper and make it official. And I'm really quite... Sorry to interrupt, Paul, but I'm actually still waiting for the other guys to follow suit. I mean, obviously Mercedes took the big leap, but... you know, I don't think BMW has yet, have they?
No, and it is worth pointing out as well that, I don't know, I was having a look at all the reviews of the Defender and I thought, okay, you know, Land Rover kind of sometimes on the nose with reliability and stuff like that, but they launched with the 5-year warranty. But on top of that, their cap price servicing, if you prepay for 5 years, is something like $1,700. It is incredibly cheap. Then on top of that, they also do a guaranteed future value program. So, I mean, to me, that would fill me with confidence knowing that I have a 5-year warranty, I have a guaranteed resale value in the future, and I also have a capped price on what my servicing is going to cost me. It kind of all adds up to just saying, okay, well, I'm just going to go buy this vehicle now.
It's about $2,000 for the diesel and $2,700 for the petrol or thereabouts. So it's for 5 years. That's pretty cheap. Hey, like I've spent more servicing a Ford that I used to own in 1 year than that. So I'll be pretty happy with that.
It's interesting Jaguar, Land Rover and Range Rover says in the story announced a 5-year warranty. It was offer in April and it hasn't finished yet. So I wonder quietly if they're just going to keep it that way.
Look, I think when a car company officially extends its warranty, it has to, you know, set aside a certain amount of money for those additional periods of years. And it has to set it aside now. So it's not like it can go, yeah, we're going to give you a 7-year warranty and sort of deal with it in year 6 and 7. It actually has to account for that in its accounting system the minute it sells the car. So I think the reason they probably haven't made it permanent just yet is because they want to give themselves the leeway in case, you know, times get tough and they have to pull it. But once you do a Mercedes and go, yep, it's 5 years, then you can't go back from that, right? No car company is ever going to go, well, we were giving 5 years officially, but now we're going to go back to 3. That would be, you know, the internet would melt.
God.
And, well, some good news for Mazda, especially the CX-5. It's finally getting the new Mazda Connect infotainment system, as first seen on the Mazda 3. It has Apple CarPlay and Android Auto enabled in it. It's all viewed on a new 10.25-inch screen as well, so it was up from 8 inches. There's more information for the local market yet to be finalized, but we can say that the US market revealed AEB for reverse driver attention alert and a 3-year trial of Mazda connected services. So no word if we're going to get all of that just quite yet. Other functionalities include an in-car Wi-Fi hotspot and remote locking and unlocking and turning on and off the car via an app, which is really cool. We have seen on a few other cars recently. We've seen the Toyota RAV4 guys skyrocket through the sales charts and bump the CX-5 down a bit. Do you reckon this might help a little bit more for it?
Look, it's one of these things where it was kind of inevitable that it was coming. What I find strange, I'm looking at the pictures now on the website of the infotainment system, they've still retained the old MZD Connect switchgear, you know, little iDrive controller thing. It is interesting that they've kind of gone halfway with it, which I think is kind of strange. But look, I think any of this stuff always adds appeal to these models. And that infotainment system itself is actually pretty good to use. The connected services will be handy. I'm keen to know from listeners, let us know at podcast@carexpert.com.au, how many of you that have connected services actually use them? I know with our Tesla, I use it a fair bit to preheat the car and to do software updates and whatever, but I wonder how many people actually use it on an internal combustion car where the engine switches on and you can't really use it in a garage. Let us know over email.
And lastly, Paul, the 2021 Toyota Hilux, there have been changes made for the DPF.
That's right. There's a class action underway at the moment with regards to customers that were inconvenienced by their Hiluxes and their Fortunas and Prados with regards to diesel particulate filter issues. If you ever see a Hilux on the road that's pumping out white smoke, that is a faulty DPF that the owner hasn't had fixed for whatever reason. Toyota is now confident that that's fixed, and they've said that the facelifted model has updates to its engine tune, which will continue to improve the way the DPF operates. About midway through that Hilux, Fortuna and Prado cycle, they actually installed a manual DPF burn switch to overcome some of these issues and allowed customers to come in to have these problems resolved. But it really has put a big dent in the reputation of the Hilux, which was always really known as being the most reliable car in this segment, and it kind of eroded away once they started having these particulate filter issues.
So, Paul, you're an apparent engineer. So can you explain to me if you're a car manufacturer and you're building a car, and one as popular as the Hilux, how do you get that wrong? Like, how does it work? Well, how did they get to that? Is it an Australia only issue, or like, how does that not get picked up in testing?
You know what I reckon it is, and something that I think they've learnt since developing this car. I know with a lot of engineering programs, cars and manufacturers brag about how many millions of kilometres of testing they do. And often these cars will run for 24 hours a day. They'll change hands to other engineers that will work on durability or other bits and pieces. I genuinely don't think anyone actually got into a Hilux and did what 99% of customers do, which is get into the car in the morning, drop the kids off at school, drive home, and then do the exact same thing over and over again. And as a result of that, we're in this situation where I don't think they ever tested this, because if they did, they would see how inadequate that diesel particulate filter is at actually operating for short trips that 99% of consumers are actually going to do.
Mm. While we're thinking of on the engineering topic, Paul, for anyone who doesn't know how a DPF works, how does it work?
Okay, so a diesel particulate filter is effectively like a sieve, and you're putting in a whole bunch of clumpy bits and then a whole bunch of little bits like flour. The flour falls straight through. That's just your standard emissions that come out of the exhaust, but all the clumpy bits are the nastiest particulates that'll get stuck into your lungs and can do damage to your health. The whole concept is that as that becomes full, it triggers a burn cycle, which elevates exhaust temperatures to a point where there's enough hot gas in there to burn off the diesel particulates so they don't sort of affect anyone anymore, and then it regenerates the filter so you can start clogging it up again effectively. Now, in this instance, there was never a point where these cars were able to reach that operating temperature where they can burn the particulate filter, and then as a result of that, they just kept grabbing particulates, and eventually it just bypasses the filter altogether. And that's when you see all the white smoke coming out. And unfortunately, that is the worst of the gases that are coming out of these cars. And they're just driving around everywhere, pumping it out into the atmosphere.
Does that mean, Paul, that if your Hilux is a sovereign citizen, it doesn't need a filter?
Maybe that's the argument they use when they get pulled over. They go, no, I'm a sovereign citizen. I don't need to wear one of those. So, yeah, actually, a lot of people actually remove those things to increase the power output of their cars, and they think they're all clever because they're able to get a few extra kilowatts out of their cars over the manufacturer specification. Little do they realize that these cars have to operate in quite a narrow tolerance band for emissions. So when you remove all the emission control equipment, you're actually just killing the environment as you drive along in your slightly more powerful car.
If you would like to read up on more of news from this week, you can head to carexpert.com.au. Our next guest on the Car Expert podcast, Will Stopford. Hello.
Hello, Mandy. How's it going?
Very good. I've got to say congratulations on an excellent piece you wrote last week called 10 Holdens You May Have Forgotten About. Can you tell us why you decided to write this?
Look, as you probably would have known, I wrote for many years for a blog called Curbside Classic. So historical articles like this are right in my wheelhouse. But also, I feel like I have a really strong connection with the Holden brand, and I'm sure a lot of Australians will be able to relate to that. I grew up in the back of a VH Commodore. It was banana yellow with brown vinyl seats and matching rust. My first car was actually a hand-me-down from my parents. It was a 97 Astra with faded red paint and had one wheel cover left, and one of the doors didn't open, and plastic trim pieces would fall off like with reckless abandon. But nevertheless, I just have always had this connection with Holden, and I've always been like a bit of a General Motors fan, even though they keep shutting down brands that I like. So that's why I was really excited to write this. And also, I was really excited about getting into automotive journalism because I'm like, among all the cars I'm going to be able to review, I'm going to be able to review Holdens as well. That's really cool. And then right as I get my first press cars to review, Holden shuts down. So
thanks, Will.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. It was all me.
We did see those really sad photos, I think, 10 days or so ago of a Holden dealership sign being removed from a dealer who's been selling since 1927. That was, I think, for people who aren't even Holden fans, that would have really tugged at the heartstrings.
Yeah, that was in just near Broken Hill, I think, and that was really disappointing. That dealer had been there since just after the Second World War. So I think it's incredibly sad, and I don't know. I'm just going to vent very quickly here. I know you guys did this on the last podcast, but I think it's a little bit cheap and nasty that GMSV is now coming in and coming to do stuff in Australia. It's like, oh, hold on a second. You can't just come and kill that brand, fire all those people, and then come back and go, oh, yeah, by the way, we're employing 150 people. It's like, oh, thank you. Great job, guys. Anyway.
Yeah, my local Holden dealership, where my Astra was originally from, I believe, it's now completely devoid of Holdens except in the used car section. And there's a single car, I drove past the other day, there's a single car sitting in the showroom, and it's one of the last Chevy Camaros that was converted by HSV. The Holden signage is still up for now. Obviously, a lot of these Holden dealerships have also done like quite substantial upgrades to their dealerships, including all the logos and that outside quite recently. So it'll be very interesting to see what starts to fill Holden dealerships around the country. I'm certainly going to miss the Holden brand, not just because of all the amazing cars that they developed here locally, especially the last VE and VF Commodore series, but also because, and I touch on this in the article as well, the sheer amount of just random product decisions that they made, you know, switching from rebadged Suzukis and Nissans and Isuzu products to Daewoos and then GM Korea products, bringing in Opels and then getting rid of them and then bringing them in again. Models like the Tigra that were sold here for 2 years. There's just a lot of just orphan nameplates all throughout Holden's history. And unfortunately, the last few nameplates that they introduced here have ended up being orphans because what the Equinox and Acadia would have only been on sale for about 2 or 3 years when Holden actually shut down. So it's a bit sad.
So the one that really surprised me in your story, Will, was the Holden Royale. just over the water in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, one of the guys that used to ride on Curbside Classic as well, he actually shot me a message to let me know a little bit more of the backstory with the Royale and the small engined Commodores, for lack of a better term. Basically, a Holden built Commodores in New Zealand up until the VP, and for some reason they always insisted on having a small engine kind of base model. So the Royale was the plushest version of whatever small engine model they had, and the Royale lasted up until, from memory, the VN. But basically, that they would just put all kinds of small engines in there. They had a 2-liter inline six that they had in the VL. They had a 2-liter four cylinder, related to the engine they used in the Chimera, that they put in the VN Commodore, which is just really strange. But I mean, the worst of all those engines was, of course, the original Starfire 1.9-liter four-cylinder, which I remember, back in the day, all the journos would call it the misfire, because it was effectively, from what I understand, it was just one of the old Holden sixes that they just basically hacked two cylinders off, so it was a bit rough, and they put it in their Toyota Corona as well, from memory. So,
wow.
Bit of trivia.
That's a much smaller car.
Mm.
My mum always wanted a bright yellow V2 Monaro. She's still dreaming of owning one of them. But you said that the one that's been mostly forgotten about is the CV6 Monaro.
Yeah, and it's kind of like what we've seen with the Ford Mustang EcoBoost and the Kia Stinger 2-liter turbo. Everyone wants the coolest model, even if it's more expensive. If you're buying a Mustang, you want a V8. And if you're buying a Monaro, you wanted a V8 as well. So they offered that supercharged V6, no manual, just a 4-speed automatic, because that's all that was available with that particular engine.
That's all that it deserves.
Basically, they only offered it for a very short period of time, and then they just got rid of it. And I imagine it was slow sales were to blame. That was actually probably the hardest car in that top 10 list to find official photos of, and it's a Monaro. So that's really weird. Just all the press photos that I could find, CV8, CV8. I'm zooming in on all the logos, all CV8. So Holden didn't really pay it that much attention, and ultimately buyers didn't either, because, I mean, why would you? Just may as well get the V8 if you're getting a Monaro.
Have you guys ever seen a Holden Volt on the road?
One. Yes, really? One. And I think it was, I don't know if it was like a local government kind of fleet car or something, but it wasn't a private car. They're very good cars from everything that I've read. And I think they've got pretty cool styling. They toned it down with the second generation model that wasn't sold here. It probably looked a little bit more like a cruise, but they were really cool cars, and they were really quite significant for General Motors, at least in North America, because that basically kind of helped them get through bankruptcy proceedings by being able to say to the US government, hey, look, we can actually make fuel-efficient cars. We're not just building a bunch of Chevy Suburbans and Cadillac Escalades. But then they actually axed it quite recently.
I think it was a slightly ahead of its time in Australia. It was a good car to drive, and it looked really cool, but it was too expensive, and I just don't think people were ready for that type of EV just yet.
Yeah, exactly. And 60 grand, I mentioned in the article as well, when they adjusted the pricing of the Caprice with the WN refresh, the Volt was actually the same price as a V8 Caprice. And, I mean, we know what a lot of consumers are like in this country. You know, they really value bang for your buck. And I don't think either that a lot of people would have thought to go to a Holden dealership to buy something of that nature. And even in Australia, I mean, it's not like the Toyota Prius really lights up the sales charts either. So some of these green models just traditionally have not done very well here.
I'm going to say the one Holden that you may have forgotten about model that you covered, the one I would have, the Holden Piazza.
Yeah, look, it's an example of a car that's translated from concept to production with very few changes, and that's great. How it actually drove, not so much. It's just putting too much power in an old Gemini chassis, really.
Sorry to disappoint you, Mandy.
I know. But, like, look at those wheels. They're so 1980s.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I've got to admit, I love styling. I love that kind of 80s wedge-shaped styling. You know, if it looks like you can poke an eye out on the sheet metal, that's the kind of styling I really love. So Piazza really appeals to me in that respect. But I also mentioned in the article the coupe that came after it, which was the Calibra. Calibra, I can't remember how we pronounce it in this country. I say Calibra. But it was the opposite because it was very, very, very smooth and extremely aerodynamic even by contemporary, even by modern standards. So it's very interesting seeing all these models that Holden brought here and then got rid of. Well, the Calibra actually stuck around for a little while longer though, now that I think about it.
We don't really have time to go through all the rest of the models you covered, but what were some of the ones that you missed writing about with?
I know. I had to keep it down to 10. I already thought it was. Getting a little bit long, but I had to cut a few. Probably some that come to mind. The locally converted Holden Barina Cabriolet. If anybody remembers that.
Wow.
I
did see one of those, actually. I took a picture of it because I had never seen one in my life and I was like, oh, my God, that's a thing.
Exactly. A few others, the Holden Insignia VXR, another one of those kind of opal orphan models that was sold here for a few years and then dropped, the big Suburban, that was a rebadged Chevrolet Suburban, and one that actually has I have a close attachment to, being as my first car was a TR Astra. There was a top spec TR Astra that had the 2-liter and a 5-speed manual. It was called the GSI, and all the press photos of it had it in this like ridiculous banana yellow. And I always freaking wanted one, even though it was the hatchback and the sedan looked so much better. I really wanted one. I've never seen one, not a single one on the road. So that's like my white whale. If I ever see one on car sales or something, I will probably get it.
Well, you can read the incredibly informative article now up at carexpert.com.au. It was a really great read, Will. Thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me nerd out, both in writing and on the podcast. It's been great.
Scott Colley, hello.
Hello, everybody.
You've been busy comparing two affordable electric cars, the 2020 Hyundai Ioniq Premium and the Nissan Leaf.
I have. I'm going to be honest, I've had to cheat a little bit and open the Comparo because I actually wrote this in April, but it's just gone live during lockdown, which is good.
Awesome. So we probably should start with the pricing first.
You can have an Ioniq cheaper than you can have a Leaf, but the car on test was the Ioniq Electric Premium, which starts at $53,010 before on-roads, whereas the Leaf is only available in one grade, and that's $49,990 before on-roads. So realistically, if you're leasing these cars or, you know, doing them on a fleet deal, they're going to cost around the same amount.
Just something that I noticed there on price when it comes to Leaf. I got sent an email by a friend of mine the other day that said that Prestige Motorsport is importing the 62 kilowatt hour Leaf, which is the one with the bigger battery, to Australia.
I think it's called the E+.
Yes, for a cheaper price than the Australian one. Which will be interesting because when they get the green light, sort of approval to import these things outside of the manufacturer, they often don't have all the overheads associated with it. So I'll be interested to see how Nissan handles that because you've got a 40 kilowatt hour version or the 62. It's sort of like a no-brainer which one you're going to choose.
I suppose the counter to that is that the 40 kilowatt hour version has a 5-year manufacturer warranty, roadside assist, all that sort of thing, whereas the importer one doesn't have that dealer network and that backing. But with an electric car, there's less to go wrong.
How is that importer bringing that car in, out of curiosity? Like, how does that even work? I thought they wouldn't be allowed to.
I'd imagine on a big ship.
See, now, Elbows, that is what Scott calls a joke, and everyone else doesn't, though. So that's the key difference there. Now, that's a really good question because my understanding was as well that if the model was available for sale, regardless of whether it's a variant or not, that you can't then import it. So I genuinely don't understand that. So I'll do some more digging, and maybe for next week's podcast we can actually find out exactly what the story is with that.
I know there are some exemptions for vehicles that are accessible for people with wheelchairs, for example. There may be other exemptions for low emissions vehicles if you've got a certain reason for bringing it in. That's the only real proper reason I can think of.
What's the difference in the range between the two, Scully?
So although the Leaf has been around longer, it's actually got a slightly bigger claimed battery size at 40 kilowatt hours, it won't go quite as far as the Ioniq on the WLTP test cycle. So Nissan claims 270 kilometers and Hyundai claims 311 kilometers, and that's on the back of a recent update to the Ioniq.
I often find as well, Scott, with the Hyundai products, the electric vehicles, they're actually quite accurate in terms of their range. And I think Tesla recently rolled out an update, which is made.
You couldn't help but bring that in. Can you?
It's going to come up,
spot,
wasn't it?
You can spot the Tesla owner. They're like a demon in the corner. Every time someone talks about me, they just have to mention that they own one.
Do you want to know I'm a Tesla owner?
The reason I brought that up is because they actually rolled out an update recently that made the range actually very accurate. And it just makes me wonder how Hyundai have been able to nail it from the outset without having to go through iterations of this, where some manufacturers are still wildly inaccurate when it comes to the range you expect from an electric car.
No, Scott, while you were doing this comparison, did at any point did you try and answer the most obvious question of why would you actually ever buy one? Like, was that a concern? No, I mean, it's a serious question. Like, is there any reason why anyone should look at these two cars instead of a conventional one?
It's very much based on your use case. And at the moment, even though these are the two most affordable electric vehicles in Australia, they're still not cheap. So they're aiming either for fleet buyers, and if you are a big fleet that wants to lower its emissions as part of a big corporate social responsibility movement, then these make a lot of sense. But also there are people who are well off and living in around the city who, you know, don't travel far and want to do what they see as the right thing. So I think it is still a limited use case, because obviously $50,000 buys you a lot of normal internal combustion hatchback. But both of these cars have the range, the space inside, and I would argue they're good enough looking now. They're still not, you know, traditionally attractive, but they don't look like science experiments. That if you are the sort of person who wants to get around in a clean and quiet way, then they're the sort of people that are going to be buying these.
Can I say as well that with our car, when we charge it, it costs around $4 for a full charge. So, I mean, obviously the cost up front on an electric car is higher, but the excuse of, you know, why would you buy it? It's kind of the same thing with an iPhone. I know that every year an iPhone comes out. Elbows, you're one of those noobs that lines up with everyone at the store there so that you can get your little iPhone.
I keep my 1.5 meter distance now for
that. That's right. Lineup. But it's the same sort of thing, right? You don't necessarily need that iPhone, but you want it because it's the new thing and it's the best thing. Well, you know,
but in this case, this isn't the best thing. That's what I'm trying to point out.
No, but it is the new thing, right? So if you want to be an early adopter and have new technology, this is kind of the car equivalent of that. And I mean, all you have to do is point at the Toyota Yaris, which has now become like nosebleedingly expensive. Hatchbacks and small cars are now becoming quite expensive at that premium end regardless. So you're kind of bridging the gap between the two eventually.
I think the other thing to remember is, although they might not be necessarily our first choice if we were buying a car ourselves because we have different priorities, it is really nice driving an electric car in the city, whether it's an Ioniq or a Leaf or a Tesla. I have owned three cars. They've all been manuals and I've driven them in the city. So I'm not the sort of person who doesn't enjoy driving. But by the same token, there's real satisfaction to be had in one pedal driving in an electric car. And like in the Ioniq and the Leaf, I would argue, or in fact, I did argue, is the smoother driving car. It's got a more sort of smoothly calibrated motor and better regenerative braking than the Hyundai. But both of these cars are really quiet, really smooth, and really punchy in town. And there's definite benefits for drivers who, you know, if you are buying a low-end hatchback or even a more expensive hatchback, you can pay a lot for a BMW 1 Series with a 3-cylinder engine. I would argue that the driving experience in an electric car is, for a lot of people, preferable to that because it is smoother and quieter and you have more punch under your right foot.
Interesting.
Which one did you give the win to, Scully?
So the win went to the Ioniq. The Leaf, for me, was a little bit disappointing, and that's because Nissan was actually a real pioneer in the electric car space. The first Leaf beat a lot of manufacturers to the punch. It was a real sort of game changer in that it was an electric car, and again, it wasn't pretty, but it also didn't look like a pure science experiment. It had just enough range to be useful day to day. And so I expected more from the second generation Leaf. It felt like Nissan really should have moved the game on, given it is a leader in that space. And we've now seen what it can do with the Ariya, which makes the fact the Leaf is, it feels a little bit like a parts bin special inside. There's some weird omissions, like the steering column doesn't adjust for reach, it only adjusts for height and tilt. Lots of little things like that add up. Whereas the Ioniq, although it's still fairly new, it's already been facelifted and already has Hyundai's latest cabin tech. It feels a little sharper to drive, the handling, but more than that, it's just a nicer package. I think the other side of that is the Leaf has some stuff the Ioniq doesn't. And if you are a real nerd's the wrong word, but if you're the sort of person who enjoys,
definitely the right word.
If you are the sort of nerd then that has, you know, a big battery in your house, solar power, and you're interested in bi-directional charging and that sort of thing, the Leaf is one of the only electric cars in Australia that can accept charge from a wall box but also give it back and use the big onboard battery as essentially a generator, which is something that a few Australian companies are now starting to investigate, and something that's going to become more prevalent going forward. Because
it's funny you say that, Scott, because I'm building a house at the moment with a huge solar system on the roof, and and the guy who did the solar suggested that I could either put the power wall in downstairs, or I could buy an old Leaf and use that to just store the power, and I can also drive it when I want to. And I was like, that's an interesting choice, because the Powerwall is quite expensive, and I reckon I could find an old Leaf for not too much of a difference in price, the first gen Leaf. So it's an interesting thing to think about, isn't it? You could actually use it now as a storage facility.
It'll be more reliable than your Ferrari as well, which would be
cool. Yeah.
The other thing with these is in Japan and some other markets where electric vehicles are a little more established, already cars with bi-directional charging are being sort of pitched as something for people who live in areas with unstable power. So if you do live in an area of Japan that's prone to earthquakes or typhoons, if the power goes out because of a natural disaster, if your house is wired up correctly with a wall box, the 40 kilowatt hour battery in your Leaf can actually power your house or your business or something like that. So the Leaf is a little nicer to drive. It's a little smoother. It's also got some tech that the Hyundai just doesn't. So there are pros to both, but for me, the Hyundai is more convincing as a package, nicer inside. It's also got a better range, which if you do like driving longer distances, and a lot of people do, I know I, you know, still enjoy when you actually can in Melbourne, obviously, packing up the car and hitting the road, the Hyundai makes more sense in that context.
It was definitely a close win to the Ioniq. Scully rated it 8.2 over the Nissan Leaf 7.9, and that comparison is under the reviews link at carexpert.com.au. And Scott Colley, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
It's no secret Porsche is proud of its past. To mark the first 911 Australian delivery in 1965, Porsche Centre Melbourne and Porsche Centre Sydney have teamed up to design the Porsche 911 1965 Reimagined. To find out more, we are joined by essentially the brainchild behind this project, Lee Hallett, the General Sales Manager at Porsche Centre Sydney. Hello, Lee.
Hi, how are you going?
Very good. Can you give us an idea on what the 911 1965 Reimagined is?
Look, it's a project that we were sort of thinking about for a while, and we were at a conference actually in Milan when we were allowed to travel back in November, and we were sort of sitting down and having a chat with a couple of our German colleagues, sort of, you know, floating the idea of doing something like this, as it was an exclusive manufacturer roundtable event. So that's sort of the forum to bring it up in, and they were very supportive of our idea, and we sort of got back to Sydney all excited and decided to build the cars. And that's kind of how it started. We sort of took the old car and as many sort of design cues that we could find in the old car, we put into the new car to sort of reimagine it in 2020.
Can you give us an example of some of those cues you took from the old car?
Yeah, look, we tried to get the colour as close to possible as the original, which is crayon in the current colour range. We've got the agave green interior, which matches the green interior of the original car. You know, the stainless steel tailpipes, the Paldao wood inside the vehicle. You know, aluminium gear selector, all the little cues that we could find, we tried our best.
Lee, tell me, when it comes to customizing a 911, what exactly can you do? Is it kind of limitless in terms of what a customer is able to do when it comes to personalizing their car?
Yeah, look, Porsche are happy to take any sort of suggestions and work with them. They do what's called a feasibility study. So if there is something that's completely not in the range of options, we can do what's called a CXX request with the factory, and they can do a feasibility study to see if it's possible to do that.
I did see one car once that I thought is resale 101 of what never to do, which was a yellow Cayenne diesel. Do you ever knock back requests that people come up with?
Look, we never knock back a request. We do have some wild specifications that people do request. We try and educate and coach clients as much as we can, but sometimes the options are a bit wild.
Lee, does Porsche Australia own that specific 1965 911? Do you know of its history?
Yeah, it's owned by a very, very nice gentleman based in Adelaide. So he bought the car off the first or the second owner. It's quite a nice story. He bought it when he was 21.
Wow.
I think he's had it for 18 years. So he bought it when he was 21. It was his neighbor's vehicle that he just kept knocking on the door saying, basically, I want to buy your car when it's for sale. And eventually the guy decided to sell it, and he bought it as his car when he was 21 years old, which is great.
How much do you reckon that's worth now, Lee?
It's hard to know in its current condition. The history of the car, it's kind of worth whatever someone's prepared to pay, but it's probably up to $400,000 or $500,000, I think.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
That is incredible.
Have you got him to trade it in for a new one? Are you convincing me of that?
I must admit, I did a lot of the driving of the car when we were doing the photo shoots, and I fell in love with it. It's such a cool old car.
Yeah. Were there any features that you found when comparing them that were similar?
Look, I think the amazing thing is you can, the gauges, the way you sort of, other than sort of your, in the older 911s, obviously you don't sit sort of straight facing the front of the car. You sort of face into the pedal box is sort of in towards the center of the vehicle. But other than that, it does feel like a 911. It is the door cards, the way the car is, they definitely do carry the design cues into the new one.
I got to say, we did a Porsche event at the Bend last year, and they had a few dealers there, and it's actually quite interesting. The dealers were talking about the popularity of the 911 and certainly some of the GT models in Australia, and how willing Australian customers are to spend big dollars on some of these. And I think they were saying the Adelaide dealership has per capita or something the most GT sales globally. I could just be making all this up, but just in general, Australians seem to be really gelled with GT3, GT2 and the RS vehicles as well. Do you find that the Australian customer is using these for track events, or are they just buying them because they want the most expensive ones that are available?
Oh yeah, we definitely see a lot of our customers using them at the track events more and more every year. We host a few track days a year as a dealership, and the numbers are just growing and growing and growing. Quite often our days sell out now, which, go back five years ago, it was harder to get enough people to sort of make the track day feasible. But now it's almost a sellout every time. So, we're definitely seeing that, people using these cars a lot more on the track. It's, obviously with the strict road laws that we have in Australia, it's the only way you can really exploit the car.
And do you think it's also partly because these cars are so easy to drive now? A lot of people will feel like they're going fast but may not actually be approaching the limits of their vehicle.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we see traction control and stability control save people regularly at the track days.
Alborz knows about that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're talking about Merrick there at the last Porsche track day. I've done the Porsche driver training school at Queensland Raceway here, and I got to say that was actually one of the best. I do a lot of track days. I do at least two or three a month, and that Porsche Level 4 that they do with the GT3 RS when I was doing it, I think they usually do it with the GT3s, but when I did it with the GT3 RS, it was honestly the level of detail they go into with all the feedback and all the race engineer stuff. I think I learned how to drive so much better after that day. It was really quite really quite an incredible day. But yeah, man, like the 911 is an amazing car, and it's so awesome to see you guys do something like that for our market, because we hardly ever get anything Australian specific, so it's good to know that somebody cares.
Thanks. Yeah, no, it was you know, we've seen them do a lot of these special editions throughout the world at the round tables that we visit, and you know, UK have had a lot of special editions that they've brought out specific to their market. So we wanted to try and do something in Australia. Obviously, our numbers are a lot smaller, so it's a little bit harder to get these things across the line. But yeah, we managed to make it happen.
Lee, these aren't going to be produced for production, I'm assuming?
No, we built two cars for in Australia. So there's one for mm-hmm. Sydney South and one down in Porsche Melbourne. So that's it at this stage. You know, it was built to be exclusive and to really show off what customers can do if they want to. You know, we've got a lot of customers that own classic cars in the country, and it'd be great to see some people try and do a similar thing with their own cars in a modern car.
Yeah. You can see the video of these two cars side by side and the story at carexpert.com.au. Lee, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that puts an end to this week's podcast. Just a gentle reminder to go check out the new site, carexpert.com.au. It has been given an extensive renovation, as we mentioned in the introduction there. Paul, we've got quite a few reviews coming up with utes this week.
That's it. We've just published the all-new D-Max, the updated Hilux. We've got an FX4 either live or about to be published. So it is all go for utes at the moment, and we're really keen to get your feedback. So check out the Isuzu D-Max review. We have the website. Shoot us an email, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Let us know your thoughts on the ute segment at the moment. Do you think it's changed enough? And do you reckon the D-Max has what it takes to take on the rest of the utes in the segment? We're really keen to get everyone's feedback to see what you think. Let us know whether you want us to do a big ute comparison as well, because I think that's high on our list if people are interested in it.
Mm, awesome. And Alborz, what cars is Chris Atko Atkinson in?
So we've actually completed the Audi S3 and the Audi S4 around Queensland Raceway. We've got lap times for those. So that's going to go live with the corresponding performance review this week. There's also a BMW M550i, which was the
That'll most... be interesting.
Well, it was the most surprising car we have ever had yet on track. So
tell me, did it sound good?
It sounded okay. It wasn't that loud. It sounded better on the inside, because I suspect the noise is fake. But okay. The lap time that it set around the track, we were all quite shocked by. And that wasn't even the M5. So it'll be an interesting
to come back to see live. That.
Yeah. And also coming up, we've got a Lexus RCF going around the track and a new 911. So Carrera S. So that'll be exciting to see how they go.
Fantastic. And Paul, just another reminder for people to please give us a rating if they're enjoying the show.
Yeah, if you're listening to this on Apple iTunes or Apple Podcast, whatever the hell they call it today, I think it's Apple Podcasts now, or any other platform, please remember to leave us a rating if you're able to. We'd really appreciate it. It helps us supercharge the podcast and bring you even more content. And then while you're at it, if you want to have a listen to the separate series we have running, which is the Founders Podcast with Alborz, Tony and myself, it's uncensored though. So if you have young ears or children, don't let them listen to any of Alborz's
or grandparents.
Words. Or grandparents. Give a listen to that as well. But I think aside from that, thank you all for listening.
Awesome. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.